And now it's time for the Wild Side News with your host, Sydney Wildsmith.
As we speak, forest fires are blazing in Georgia and Florida. A new fire has broken out in New Jersey. The boundary waters of Minnesota and Canada are burning. The legendary Catalina Island in California witnessed a dangerous blaze. It's fire season. Today, we get an update on the fires and focus our attention on what happens to the wildlife as fires rage through the forests, swamps, and grasslands. And we have two special guests who share a bit of their new performance on the weekly Earth Summit. It's all coming up when your Voice of the Earth continues here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
Try to imagine for just a moment if you saw a raging forest fire head your way. As we speak, thousands of people around the country are facing this question. Most would pick up whatever they can, hop in their cars, and flee. But what of the wild creatures? How do they deal with forest fires? We bring you some updates on the fires and then head to the Okefenokee National Wildlife Refuge in southern Georgia and talk with Ranger Sally Gentry about how the wildlife there are faring as over 50% of the refuge has been burned. That's coming up in our second segment. But as always, we begin today's show with the most important 15 minutes on Earth as we hear from the world's leading scientists, activists, and advocates for nature in our weekly Earth Summit. And today, we have two very special guests joining the summit who will provide a wonderful sampler from their newest performance, Sea Change, Reversing the Tide. So now, join us for this latest Voice of the Earth special edition. This is Sydney Wildsmith. I want to welcome you all to this week's very special Weekly Earth Summit, bringing you the most important 15 minutes on Earth each and every week. Today, we will be hearing from many of our regular panelists who continue to bring you up to date on the changes and opportunities we face in uniting to restore a balance to our Earth. I thank you for attending, and please tell your friends and associates to join our global network of Friends of the Earth. And today we have two special guests who will close out this week's summit with a very special performance from their upcoming series of live performances of Sea Change, Reversing the Tide. It's a most elegant and powerful tribute to nature, life, and wonder. So I'd like now to introduce our first regular panelist, Dr. Mark Beckhoff, our resident ethologist, who wishes to open today's summit with a personal observation on what we have to lose if we cannot act in time to save the wild creatures. Dr. Beckhoff?
A lot of people are interested these days in the loss of species, mass extinctions. You know, we're in the sixth period of extinction, and it's unprecedented in terms of the anthropogenic, if you will, or human-caused extinctions. And people say, you know, what are we going to lose? Well, we're going to lose a lot of species. We're going to lose habitats as these species leave, of course. Either, you know, the habitats will be converted by humans into apartment houses, which probably won't happen. But you know, we'll be taken over perhaps for growing crops. But what I think we also lose, in addition to the species and the habitat, is we just lose, if you will, part of who we are. I like to think of all beings as being connected on Earth, and so that a loss of a particular species or even the reduction of the numbers of a particular species down very low to where they may not be sustainable over time is really just a loss of kin. It's kind of loss of a brother or a loss of a sister. And I think what those losses are going to do sooner than later, is I think they're going to be crazy-making. I tell my classes that these losses are going to be crazy-making in the sense that we will be losing a connection to the world, if you will, the animal world, the world of other nature. We'll be alone. We won't be able to stand the cold, as the philosopher Nietzsche said. And so that's what I'm really concerned about. And there's wonderful people, of course, working on conservation, from my colleague and friend Jane Goodall to George Shala to innumerable people. It would be just ridiculous to try to list them all. But I do think that those will be our losses, a loss of wildness, a loss of nature, and a loss of attachment. We still have very old brains, although we're pretty advanced in other ways. And I think our old brains really, really crave connection to nature. So that's where I'm at now.
Thank you, Dr. Beckhoff. Dr. Beckhoff, besides being a world-class animal behaviorist, is also a prolific writer. So I encourage you to Google Mark Beckhoff, that's MarkBeckoff, to find and explore with him the wonders of animal intelligence, emotion, and play through his many books and articles. Now, preserving biological diversity, as you all know, is a primary aim of all of our panelists. I want to now introduce another of our regular panelists, Dr. Thomas Lovejoy, who played a key role in bringing this concept, biological diversity, into our awareness. Dr. Lovejoy.
In 1980, there were three of us who used the phrase biological diversity for the first time. We were basically, each of us was looking for a way to describe the total variety of life on Earth. And so we all came independently to the phrase. We just wanted a way to talk about this, the extraordinary richness of life on this planet, whether we looked at it at the level of an individual species and all its variation, or the whole variety of species on Earth, or the variety of ecosystems, which in the end makes this planet a truly glorious and exciting place to live. It's beautiful, it's wonderful, it's inspiring. It also happens to be the very basis for our existence. Biological diversity does all kinds of stuff for us. You know, it underpins us biologically, it performs ecosystem services, it provides sort of basic encyclopedia about living systems on Earth. But it's also, you know, it's just extraordinarily beautiful and wonderful. And I think one of the most important things each and every person should do with some frequency is just stop for a minute and, in a sense, smell the roses of the diverse planet on which we live. Because, you know, anytime you really stop and look at a plant or an animal, how it's put together and how it works, it's enthralling. And to lose any of it is worse than the worst book burning one can imagine. Just a wonderful, beautiful, inspiring world. We should treasure it.
Thank you, Dr. Lovejoy. Currently, Dr. Lovejoy heads the Heinz Foundation for Science, Economics, and the Environment. In order to succeed, the mandate to think globally and act locally has even more significance as we face the myriad challenges of keeping individual species from becoming extinct. The weekly Earth Summit will spotlight critical needs as identified by our panelists who work each day to protect the living diversity. Dr. Robin Moore works with the Amphibian Specialist Group of Conservation International in just such direct action. Dr. Moore identifies a critical challenge facing the world today. Dr. Moore.
The gastric brooding frog was discovered around 35 years ago. It was native to Queensland, Australia, where it lived in creeks and rainforests. It's a ground-dwelling frog very closely associated with water. It's fairly unremarkable in appearance, being small and brown. But what is very unusual about this frog is the way in which it reproduced. After breeding, the female would take the eggs into her mouth and swallow them. Here she would hold around 40 eggs until they hatched. The tadpoles would live in her stomach and metamorphose into fully formed froglets. The froglets would then emerge from the female's mouth. This highly unusual behavior was made possible by substance in the egg of the frog, which actually turned off the production of hydrochloric acid in the female's stomach. So she would not be able to feed in the whole time that the eggs and the tadpoles were present in her stomach. Unfortunately, this highly unusual frog disappeared from existence in the mid-80s. The reason for its extinction is not entirely clear, but habitat loss, pollution, and an emerging infectious disease, a fungus called chytridiomycosis, have all been implicated, and it's likely to be a combination of these factors. Sadly, this story is becoming very familiar among frogs, as we're losing many species from around the world. Not only is the loss of gastric breeding frog tragic from a perspective of losing a species, it also has implications for humans. The mechanism by which the female turned off the production of acid in her stomach is not entirely understood, and it could have implications for the treatment of ailments that affect humans, such as stomach ulcers. Now the potential for doing research has gone. We're trying to stop other species going extinct from around the world and losing similar opportunities. If you'd like to find out more information about what we're doing, please visit www.amphibians.org.
Thank you, Dr. Moore. I hope all of you will take even a little bit of your time to assist in this effort. We need global response now. The truth is, we all need to make special efforts. We now get a personal perspective on where we can look to keep our dedication alive, as we welcome one of our college voices representing the newest action generation. Ben Lowe is moving out into the world of action, having just graduated from Wheaton College. Ben?
In an era where it is easy to despair over the state of the environment, the church may be our best hope yet. For some time, economics has been the baseline motivation behind much environmental protection. We're usually willing to go green, provided we save money, or at the very least, break even. If not, then forget about it. The problem is that this only gets us so far, and often not far enough. Well, what next then? We need a new motivation to move us past the economics. This new motivation is morality. Morals compel us to take care of the environment because it is the right thing to do. This does not mean we ignore the economics, but it does mean protecting the environment may entail making sacrifices. So where do we get our morals? One obvious place is from our faith. This is what led Karl Popp to say of his generation, "We acted as if we could save life on Earth without the same institutions through which we save ourselves." For many around the world, this institution is the church. And it was Jesus himself who taught that you cannot serve both God and mammon. According to the church, then, God must be the ultimate decision-making factor, not personal gain nor financial profit. And God calls us to love our neighbors and care for his creation.
Thank you, Ben. It will be interesting to follow Ben as he applies that will to the wild choices and voices of our future. And we'd better plan on adopting this as our collective global challenge with a timeline that runs deep into this century of change. Dr. Charles Kennell has looked at the Earth from the deep recesses of space with his work with NASA to the deepest depths of the oceans as director of the Scripps Institution of Oceanography. That pretty much defines the living strata on planet Earth. So Dr. Kennell talks about a strategic and timely framework for our future. Dr. Kennell?
I think the crunch, the true crunch, is going to come in at mid-century, about 40 to 50 years' time. And the reason is, my reason is, that the UN predicts that the global population may very well level off at that time, at about 9.5 billion people. Now, that means that at that time, we're going to have to learn how to clothe, house, feed, provide employment for, and a prosperous way of life for half again as many people as presently inhabit the Earth. Now, the UN believes that the population is going to level off because of a demographic transition that has occurred in advanced economies, where the rate of growth does slow down, and people think that it is indirectly connected with prosperity and maybe more directly connected with things like education of women and so on. But nonetheless, there's a connection between prosperity and the slowing population growth. The first condition for a stable human-occupied Earth is a constant population. That can't be achieved without having economic growth around the world. Our record in the 20th century, where in the last 50 years we achieved quite a bit, particularly in Asia, our record is not so good as far as the environment is concerned, because all of that economic growth came at increased compromise of the environment and increased and unsustainable uses of resources. So the challenge is to arrive at this 50-year mark, understanding how to deal with the global environmental consequences of the economic growth that's necessary to see a stable population. And people think the crunch will actually come at that time, because the population may level off, may even peak. And our resource consumption and environmental effects will probably be greatest then. And we still won't have learned how to cope with all the challenges after 50 years. And so that's probably their critical point. Now, E.O. Wilson has called this, the great biologist E.O. Wilson has called this a bottleneck, that if we get through, we may very well be on a different path for the globe. But he's very worried. He thinks, I've heard him state publicly, that we may have lost 50% of all the species on Earth before we get through this bottleneck. So I think a number of people look forward to about 50 years as crunch time. And that's within the lifetime of our grandchildren.
Dr. Kennel will be meeting with us each week to share his perspectives. Thank you, Dr. Kennel. Sometimes the challenges seem monumental, and that's one reason Dave Foreman, founder of the Rewilding Institute, joins us each week, because he is a man of action. He invites everyone to act right now to save one highly endangered species. Dave?
Wasn't very long ago, just a few hundred years ago, that jaguars, the big spotted cat of the Western Hemisphere, ranged throughout the southern United States, from California to Tennessee. That's a surprising historical fact to most people. But today, there are a few jaguars in the United States, in extreme southern Arizona and southwestern New Mexico. But they seem to all be males. There is not a breeding population of the big spotted cat. The nearest breeding population of jaguars to the United States, it's just 100 miles south of the Arizona border in northern Sonora, where the Yaqui River headwaters are. And out of that population, few jaguars have dispersed into the United States. There are estimated to be about 120 breeding jaguars in that population, just 100 miles south of the border. The trouble is, in Mexico, there is no public land, and the prime habitat for this jaguar population is owned by a single rancher who is virulently anti-jaguar and other predators and has been killing them, even though that is illegal in Mexico. Naturalia, a Mexican conservation group, and the Northern Jaguar Project, with which the Rewilding Institute and I are associated, has been trying to raise money to buy those ranches owned by the jaguar-killing rancher, and he is willing to sell them. Already managed to purchase one ranch of about 15,000 acres and set up the Los Pavos Jaguar Preserve. But now we are trying to buy another 40,000 some acres from this rancher, which will get him out of the area, and other surrounding ranchers are open-minded and possibly friendly to jaguars. But we have to raise a lot of money right now. We have a $100,000 down payment we need to make by the end of May. And so what we are asking folks to do is to buy an acre for spot. If we're ever going to have a breeding population of jaguars back in the United States, We have to strongly protect this population of jaguars in Sonora and their dispersal routes into the United States. And so for only $49, you can buy an acre for spot down in Mexico, and we will soon have a nearly 50,000-acre jaguar preserve owned by Naturalia and the Northern Jaguar Project. To help donate and to find out more about the Northern Jaguar Reserve, just go to www.northernjaguarproject.org, and you can donate your $49 or how many acres you want to buy through that website. Thanks very much.
If anyone else feels like $49 an acre is a bargain, as I do, buy in and get the job done. This is a small price to pay for such a monumental demonstration of actions that lead to a sustainable future. Thank you, Dave Foreman. Dr. Matthew Sleeth brings his humanness and humanity to the dais each week and inspires us with his faith and commitment to serve God and save the planet. Matthew?
Not long ago, my daughter Em and I went for a walk. We wound our way along the trail that took its course between thicket and stream. It was an overcast day. We paused to study a tree overgrown with vines. In its architecture, a score of sparrows went about the business of blending in with everything. I do not spend enough time in nature, despite my telling others that it is vital to do so. It is too easy to be caught up in the world. It's too easy to forget that nature has a power to restore multitask modern humans. I spend my days and nights convincing audiences of the need to restore creation, and yet I lose sight of creation's ability to restore me. As Em and I went about our walk, we came upon an area of trees surrounding a small stream. Scattered along the stream banks are dozens of cast-off washing machines, tires, and even an automobile. This most quiet and modest of groves has been turned into a dump, a place to cast off the machinery of our hubris. In the time after our walk, the image of the grove haunted me. St. Paul writes that creation groans as a woman in the throes of painful childbirth. His description fits many natural habitats under siege by society. It describes what I had seen. As servants of the Lord, we exist to do His bidding. We are the hands, feet, and sentient instruments of the Almighty. The junk cast off by the stream is an affront to God. It is increasingly clear that we must not only cease harming the created world, we must throw ourselves into the work of healing the damage already done to it. The stream bed needs to be delivered of its travail, but who will do the work? Next week, I'll talk about the watershed's unlikely midwives.
Dr. Sleeth is a self-sacrificing man and is a new missionary for the earth. You may be amazed that Matthew makes his message available to those who ask. So contact Dr. Sleeth through his website at servegodsavetheplanet.org. I'm very pleased to welcome now two very special guests who have dedicated their lives to inspiring millions through their creative and scientific quest. Lisa Harrell is a legendary star of stage and screen who began her career with the Royal Shakespeare Company and is considered one of the finest actors alive. She met and married Roger Payne, who has studied the behavior of whales, leading over 100 expeditions to all oceans and studying every species of baleen whale in the wild. His institute has recently completed the Voyage of the Odyssey, a 5-year around-the-world research expedition to measure pollution levels in the oceans. Lisa's and Roger's shared environmental interests have led to the creation of Sea Change, Reversing the Tide, a performance piece that uses science and poetry to urge us all to make sustainable living our primary goal. We are honored and delighted to hear a brief sampling from their live performance, which will be premiering Thursday, May 24th at the Cherry Lane Theater in New York City as a first of a series of performances around the country. Please welcome Lisa Harrell and Roger Payne.
The area needed to keep up with our demands sustainably now equals the surface of this entire planet plus an area equal to the agricultural regions of Europe and Australia. But we need to ask ourselves, where are we going to get to other areas the size of Europe and Australia?
When despair for the world grows in me, and I wake in the night at the least sound, in fear of what my life or my children's lives may be, I go and lie down where the wood drake rests in his beauty on the water and the great heron feeds.
There is new evidence that the Greenland ice cap is now starting to melt, a process which, when complete, will raise sea levels by 20 feet.
If we do not begin to work together for the well-being of each other, the planet's surge of life may well be done with.
The monolithic indifference of natural laws to our preferences is total. They will never adapt to our desires, not even once. It is we who must adapt to them. Always. Every time. No exceptions.
The whales turn and glisten, plunge and sound and rise again, flowing like breathing planets in the sparkling whorls of living light.
Humanity's worst problems are solvable. Most solutions are simple. Existing scientific understanding is strong enough to get us started.
There is, in fact, a new industrial revolution underway that can prevent us from laying waste to the beauty of the world.
Because the stakes are now so high, our present predicament is actually the most singular opportunity for greatness ever offered to any generation in any civilization.
We need to seize that opportunity and act.
28 years ago, some songs of humpback whales that I had recorded were included on two golden records that were placed aboard each of the Voyager spacecraft. When Voyager 1 was 3.7 billion miles from Earth, its cameras were turned around to look back over its shoulder so that it could film the entire solar system. In the resulting image, the Earth occupies 1/8 of 1 pixel. It is shown as a pale blue dot, illuminated by what looks like a sunbeam. But it was simply a stray reflection from the spacecraft itself.
Look at that dot. That's here. That's home. That's us. On it, everyone you love, everyone you know, everyone you've ever heard of, every human being that ever was, lived out their lives. The aggregate of our joy and suffering. Thousands of confident religions, ideologies, and economic doctrines. Every hunter and forager. Every hero and coward. Every creator and destroyer of civilization. Every king and peasant, every young couple in love, every mother and father, hopeful child, inventor and explorer, every teacher of morals, every corrupt politician, every superstar, every supreme leader, every saint and sinner in the history of our species lived there. On a mote of dust, suspended in a sunbeam.
Thank you both for your soul-filled work for life on Earth. With ticket prices at $10, you can afford to plan to attend this very special premiere. To find out more, visit their website at redshiftproductions.org. So I want to thank all of our panelists who will continue to lead us and inspire us all to reverse the tidal wave of chaos and restore the balance and peace to Earth. We all look forward to meeting with you next week and every week for the most important 15 minutes on Earth at our weekly Earth Summit. Fires are raging. We seem to focus entirely on the human impact. But over this break, imagine for just 1 minute what happens to the millions of creatures whose homes are burned in any single fire. What's it all mean? We take a look when your Voice of the Earth continues here on the Wild Side News.
A dirty look. Shrinking glaciers? A nudge. Then dying coral reefs pushed us hard. Rising ocean temperatures and extreme weather? An uppercut. Then record-breaking heat waves hit us right where it hurts. Has it occurred to anyone that maybe the Earth is trying to get our attention?
We can still reduce greenhouse gas pollution. To find out how, go to fightglobalwarming.com. Brought to you by Environmental Defense, the Robertson Foundation, and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
Best estimates are that hundreds of homes and structures have been destroyed by fires in this first series of wildfires raging in states from California to New Jersey and down to the Florida Panhandle. Those are the human homes. But what about the animal homes? Any idea how many burrows, nests, dens, and homes of the wild creatures have been consumed? We're heading to the Okefenokee Swamps to take a look when your Voice of the Earth continues here on the Wild Side News. The 2007 fire season is heating up, and it's already dominating the news. With global warming likely moving the Earth into a drier, hotter trend, the wildfires are quicker to ignite and spread with the storm-driven winds into some very frightening and dangerous situations for thousands of our friends in California, Minnesota, Canada, and a new human-caused fire now rages in New Jersey. Hundreds of buildings and homes have already been lost, and the economic and community costs are staggering. But there are more to these fires than that. As most are burning in swamps, forests, mountains, and even islands, the world of nature is as well being hit, and hit hard. In Florida, the smoke has been so intense from the current fires that have moved into northern Florida from the weeks-old blaze in the Okefenokee Swamps that birds are literally dropping from the sky. Stories of bear cubs stranded in trees are appearing, and there is a much deeper story, and that's where we go, following a brief look at today's nature news. So now, the news. A big area of snow in the Antarctic melted in 2005 due to an unusually warm week in summer. Scientists believe this melt could have accelerated the underground melting, but cannot know as it would have occurred in areas that cannot be measured at this time. Although Antarctica has not been as affected as the Arctic by climate change, this event indicates unusual warming trends can have long-term impacts on the overall stability of ice sheets generally around the world. The ongoing drought in Australia could create a much worse water shortage than had been predicted. Australians have been told to brace for some of the most restrictive water use regulations on record. Many in Australia are already under tight restrictions which ban washing cars and outlaw the use of sprinklers in gardens. As well, some plans are being made to relocate farms to more northern areas of the Australian continent. Recent predictions indicate that the water levels in the nation's rivers could be fully 40% less than thought. Prime Minister John Howard has urged Australians to pray for rain. Dry conditions in Asia are kicking up a lot of dust, which is heading into the atmosphere and could impact climate in the U.S. Following a recent series of Pacific flights and especially equipped aircraft, scientists observed that dust clouds easily and regularly cross the Great Ocean, but before doing so, pick up unusually high levels of carbon particulates that can darken the skies and could absorb more heat than regular clouds. The long-term effects of the dust clouds are being determined. India is being urged to reject the campaign by the Chinese to lift bans on the trading of tiger parts. China will be appealing for removal of the ban during the next meeting of the Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species in The Hague in June. China contends that although its tiger population is down to about 30 animals, they have over 5,000 in captive breeding farms, which they use to supply the demands for tiger parts in the world's markets. Conservationists contend that although this may seem a reasonable proposal on one hand, it nevertheless will encourage the illegal poaching and killing of wild tigers by illegal brokers and would in fact lead to hurting the existing wild tiger populations worldwide. Japan is busy spreading foreign aid money to buy votes of client countries that will be voting on the whaling ban. Last year, Japan managed to get the International Whaling Commission to agree to a rather toothless declaration that the ban was unnecessary. Campaigners say Japan has been doling out aid to non-whaling countries, such as in Africa, while asking that they join the IWC, the International Whaling Commission, to sway the vote in favor of the pro-whaling proposals. Scientists report that, like humans, birds, too, have been hard hit by the West Nile virus. The virus, which has been responsible for over 12,000 cases of West Nile virus in humans, with 960 deaths since appearing in 1999, appears to as well affect birds, commonly associated with human populations, including crows, robins, chickadees, and eastern bluebirds. Crow populations have declined by 45% since 1999, and scientists attribute the cause to West Nile virus. Some scientists see a future in which many of these backyard species of birds will be essentially gone from neighborhoods. Generally, the appearance of West Nile virus results in a concurrent and equivalent disappearance of many bird species. And finally, 230 scientists signed a letter to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service offering their opposition to plans by Wyoming, Montana, and Idaho to remove the endangered status of wolves in those states. Scientists claimed that the proposals to delist the wolves were not based on real science. Currently, about 1,300 wolves exist in the three-state area. The Fish and Wildlife Service contends that that is more than enough wolves to merit the removal of protections as an endangered species. The delisting proposal could be completed by early next year, but legal challenges may keep the current status in place for some time. And that's the news. I don't like to be an alarmist, but I have to believe this could be a record-setting year of fires across America. With the effects of a long-standing drought adding to the dangers, as well as more intense storms with lightning that have been appearing with such extreme impact in recent weeks, we all need to be aware of our surroundings these days. We start out with a couple of quick updates from two of the current fire sites. First, a quick update from northern Minnesota. There's a serious forest fire that's happening up in Minnesota as well right now and isn't getting the same press that others are, possibly because it isn't threatening, or some people would say it isn't threatening as many homes, but in reality there's been many homes and other structures lost there. To get an update on what's happening in Minnesota, we're talking with Jeff Edmonds, who's the fire information officer with the incident management team. Jeff, tell us what's going on up in northern Minnesota.
Well, we have a fire here that's almost 76,000 acres. Started in Minnesota and burned into Canada in a major run a few days ago last Thursday, and then burned back into Minnesota from Canada. So it's been an international incident here. We've had a couple hundred structures threatened and lost a total of 133 on both sides as of last report. Some of those are residences, some are storage buildings and sheds. It's been a major fire, and a good portion of it is in the Boundary Waters Wilderness in northern Minnesota.
I'm just curious if you have any information on what's happening to wildlife that are impacted by these fires as they approach. What's the story on how they handle this?
Well, wildlife seems to adapt. This area, I mean, historically, is a fire-prone area. There's records of, fires as far back as they can reach with the tree rings, over the last several hundred years, and wildfire occurs here, and it has for a long time, and the wildlife has adapted to that. I'm not a wildlife biologist. I'm not real sure how they survive that, but we haven't found that. I've heard dead animals out on the fire. I've seen a few photos posted online of, like a fox curled up on a burned-out area
but the fox appears to be just fine. It's just all just huddled up on a rock like they tend to do, and so things manage to survive.
It's fascinating. What's the prognosis on the future of this fire?
It's looking really good. We've had about 3 days of fairly calm weather, higher humidity, a little bit of drizzle, not enough to put a fire out, but enough to slow down the activity and allow firefighters to get in close. And so they're building line as fast as they can. And we've lifted some evacuations just in the last couple of days. The sheriff has done that. And you know, people are pretty happy about being able to go back to their homes, even though some of them don't have homes to go back to.
Right. Jeff Edmonds, Fire Information Officer with the Incident Management Team up in Minnesota. I want to wish you guys all good luck and be safe up there and hope you get this under control.
Thank you. Appreciate that.
Mm-hmm. Bye. The Catalina Island fire appears to have burned itself out. A new fire in New Jersey is so new, we are still waiting for reports to be filed. Florida is now the current hotspot, and we now go there for this update. Now joining us from Florida is Rhonda Sutphin, who's with the Florida Division of Forestry, who is here to give us a sense of what's happening with the forest fires in Florida right now. Rhonda?
Yeah, we have several large fires burning across the state of Florida. As of today, we have 203 active wildfires that are burning 176,811 acres. And the fire we have the most concern about is the one on the Baker-Columbia County line, which is up in the Florida-Georgia state line. And that fire is now approximately 119,000 acres. So far, they've been able to contain about 50% of that fire, and the fire is still within its lines. And hopefully, the weather will be favorable again today for operations on that one. But we're worried about the weather as it comes in this weekend. The low relative humidity and high wind, the drier air that'll come in after the front may make that fire flare up.
Are there storms associated with that? Because that increases the chances of lightning as well?
Yes, there's a front that's supposed to move across the state starting today through the weekend, and there will be scattered showers, but unfortunately with that, you also get a lot of lightning.
Mm-hmm. Now, are you finding with the winds then that it takes the embers and has a capacity to really spread this beyond those your boundaries?
Yes, because when we have low relative humidity and higher winds, the fire can, what we call, spot fires anywhere from a quarter of a mile to a mile away. So if they jump over our containment lines, they start new fires elsewhere. And if we can't get to those quickly to get those suppressed, then you have another new fire.
Some people are talking about the smoke and its effect on pets and as well birds, just native birds.
It, the smoke can be a problem with these large fires because there's nowhere for it to go. So we're just asking people, if they have pets, if they can bring them indoors, try to limit people exposure and pets exposure to the smoke, which will help out a lot. And, you know, as far as wildlife and birds, they get a little disoriented with the smoke. And there's unfortunately nothing we can do about that.
Well, Rhonda Sutphin with the Florida Division of Forestries, good luck. We'll keep posted.
All right. Thank you.
The Florida fire is the direct result of fires that have been burning in Georgia for the last 2 weeks. Our report continues as we head on up to the Okefenokee swamps. Joining us now from the Okefenokee National Wildlife Refuge is Ranger Sally Gentry. Sally, welcome to the Wild Side News.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
First of all, I have to say the Okefenokee Swamp is one of the best-named national wildlife refuges in the world. I think everybody just loves the name of that.
Do you know what Okefenokee means?
No, let's start with that one then.
Okay, it's called Land of the Trembling Earth, and it actually presents the first problem that our fire crews are having in fighting this fire down here.
Why the Land of the Trembling Earth?
Well, the Okefenokee Swamp has a lot of peat as part of the bottom of this swamp, and it builds up in several feet thick in places, and so it's virtually impossible to get heavy equipment out through that swamp to fight these fires. If you were to drive them out through there, you would pretty much sink. So Land of the Trembling Earth, it's very hard to fight fires in there, as well as it being a large wilderness area, so there are no roads that go through the Okefenokee Swamp itself.
Right, which of course is what it's all about, really, is to protect these wilderness areas. It's about over 400,000 square acres and over 300,000 designated wilderness, I think. Is that about right?
It's 402,000 acres approximately, and of that, 353,000 acres are National Wilderness Area.
For those of us who haven't had a chance to visit the Okefenokee Swamp, and I'm going to have to get down there one of these days soon because I need to experience that more. You've been a ranger there. Give us a sense of what people see when they come there. What are the habitats like? What are the dominant features?
Well, the habitats are actually vary in different places of the swamp. You have something that the forested cypress wetland, which predominates the northwest side of the swamp, and that's what most people have in mind when they think of the Okefenokee Swamp. We have these large cypress trees and the waterways that kind of wind their way around the base of the trees. And then in other areas, say the northern end of the swamp, you have a lot of scrub shrub habitat, which is very thick, dense, various shrubs that grow very thickly. And then in other areas, you have open, wet, shallow prairies where you'll find a lot of your wading birds. There's also lakes that dot the Okefenokee Swamp, as well as some waterways, including the Suwannee Canal, which was a man-made feature that was put through in the 1890s in an attempt to drain the swamp.
The cypress forest, I guess, how do you refer to that, by the way? How would you refer to the cypress area?
Well, we do call it a cypress forest because that is the predominant tree. And probably the last habitat area in the Okefenokee Swamp is the forested uplands. So the sandy upland area. So there are islands within the swamp itself, even in the boggy areas, and there are upland pine sand communities around the edges of the Okefenokee Swamp where you have different sorts of vegetation that grow there as well.
Therefore, you have a terrific diversity of wildlife, and that's what I'm going to be focusing on in our discussion here. I am curious what is happening in these devastating fires. The Okefenokee Swamp has really been hit, and I think a lot of people are concerned about how in the world do wildlife native to the swamps there into your National Wildlife Refuge, how do they actually deal with this? What's happening?
Well, it depends on the wildlife you're talking about. Most of the wildlife that inhabits the Okefenokee Swamp are adapted to that ecosystem because the swamp itself is a fire-dependent ecosystem. Without fire to rejuvenate the swamp, it would basically become just a peat-filled bog. So most of the animals that survive in the Okefenokee Swamp for generations have adapted to it, and so they have ways that they can handle that situation when it happens.
Let's first of all start with the bird life. What are you observing in terms of how they've been able to react to the oncoming fires?
Well, the birds are really fortunate because they're actually able to just fly away and then return to an area. And so fire within the swamp is actually good for some of our birds like the Florida sandhill cranes and the red-cockaded woodpeckers that live there. And it's good in a way. Florida sandhill cranes, for instance, what that will do is open up those prairies, keep them from becoming filled with the shrubs that would take over. So that provides them more foraging habitat. And for the red-cockaded woodpeckers, the trees that they require to thrive are longleaf pine trees, and they live in these upland pine communities. Without fire to come through, then a lot of your other vegetation would start growing up. Some of your less fire-dependent trees would come up, and they would start crowding out the longleaf pines. And so to have regular fires and what we call prescribed fires that we actually go out and do keeps that vegetation down and keeps that habitat that the red-cockaded woodpeckers need. And red-cockaded woodpeckers are an endangered species, one of the main species that we manage for at the Okefenokee Swamp.
How is this fire coming in terms of the nesting season? Because, of course, that they could lose a considerable portion of this year's young if it comes at the wrong time. Where are you in that process?
Well, I did speak to our biologist last week about that. At that point, they had started building nests, and they had not documented any eggs or young yet at this time, so that's a good thing. So as the fire is coming through the swamp, the woodpeckers would leave, and they would return to that area and continue nesting, most likely, is
probably
what would happen.
For example, bird nests are blown out of trees all the time. They have to restart, so that's not an uncommon thing.
Well, and the woodpeckers, of course, are nesting internally in cavities.
That's true.
So they're more protected, and the longleaf pine trees that they nest in are already fire-resistant species of tree. So the fire can come through there, and those trees will still remain, and most will be okay. And in fact, we do prescribe burning just for that, you know, to keep out the other shrubs and stuff, because without doing that, then you get all this fuel buildup around the bottom of the longleaf pines. Then when you have a wildfire that comes through, the fire has a lot of what we call fuel to burn, and it, if it burns up in the tops of those trees, then it will kill those trees, so we want to keep that from happening. So we come in and we do prescribe burning on a regular cycle to keep all that undergrowth down. So when the fire does come through there, which it will, it's a natural part of that ecosystem, then it's not a devastating big fire that tops out the crowns of those trees. It will come through, burn what undergrowth is there, and keep going, and the trees will remain alive.
Maybe we should give a little history on this particular event in terms of how long it was in the swamp, and if it still is, and it's how the status of its containment, and also the nature of the fire. Was it a slow burn, which can be very difficult, or did it kind of breeze through, or what's going on?
Well, we actually have a couple of different fires burning in the swamp right now. We have one at the north end of the swamp, which started out, I believe the date was April the 16th, and it moved into the swamp on April the 22nd into the National Wildlife Refuge. And that one's sort of been creeping down through the refuge, various rates depending on the day and the wind and the fuels that it encountered. We have a second fire, and, well, the big turnaround at this point has burned about 130,000 acres. About 84,000 of that is what we call the big turnaround portion of the fire, which is a lot of that on the refuge. And then the other portion was the 46,000 acres on the Sweat Farm fire.
Well, those are big fires. That's a lot of land mass.
Yes, it is. Mm-hmm. And we have a second fire that started last Saturday night, which was May the 5th, I believe. There was a thunderstorm that came through the area. We had over 1,000 lightning strikes that night. And out of that, there were some fires that sprang up. There was one that started out on Floyd's Island Prairie around the central area of the swamp. And then we had one that started on Bugaboo Island, which is also an active nesting colony of red-cockaded woodpeckers in the middle of the swamp, in the middle of the wilderness area. And that fire on Sunday was about 300 acres. And on Monday, it ran about 9 miles south. So it covered a lot of ground in one day.
So
and now that fire, the Bugaboo Scrub Fire, mm-hmm. has grown to a total of 242,000 acres.
Right.
And 139,000 of that is just in the South Georgia part alone. And it's spilled over down into northern Florida as well.
Right. That's an ongoing event right now. In terms of the Okefenokee National Wildlife Refuge, how much of the refuge actually has been burned?
I don't have a number for that. I mean, I can look at a map and say, well, it looks like...
No, just estimate,
well,
you know.
Let me think. Mm-hmm. Okay, if we've got... The Okefenokee Swamp is 402,000 acres, and the turnaround is 84, and the Georgia portion is 139. So that's over 200,000 acres.
Mm-hmm.
Roughly half,
yeah. Let's talk a little bit about, as well, the mammal species. What would you say are some of your top five or so mammal species that you'd find in the refuge?
Well, probably our largest mammal would be the black bears. And that would be a species that would probably have some problems with this fire because they're not able to run as fast as a deer could run. They might have more trouble getting out. And there was a study recently conducted in the Okefenokee Swamp ecosystem, and they found that there were a population of about 800 black bears, but they ranged through what we call a greenway, which is basically the Okefenokee National Wildlife Refuge, and then south through Pinhut Swamp, and then into northern Florida in the Osceola National Forest. So that population of black bears normally inhabits that range.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this fire has... raced through the Okefenokee National Wildlife Refuge, has moved south into Pinhook Swamp and through Pinhook Swamp and is now in Osceola National Forest. So it's basically covering a lot of the same habitat that those black bears inhabit. That could be some concern.
Yeah, they have limited resources in terms of running. There was a story that just came out about a mother bear that was found at the base of a tree with a baby, a cub, about 60 feet up. and she was somehow protecting that tree or couldn't get up herself, but they darted both of them and were able to rescue them. So this is the type of thing that can begin to happen. I'm sure you'll be hearing some stories. But how about the things like raccoons and other smaller mammal species? Because again, they can't run as fast. What is your sense on how they're handling and responding to this fire?
There are going to be some species that are going to be negatively impacted. There are going to be some, like rabbits. You know, they have their burrows in the ground, so hopefully they'll be able to find somewhere to run to and hide until the fire blows over. Same with raccoons. They often nest in holes in trees, stumps of trees in the root base and different places like that. Hopefully they were able to find somewhere like that to hide. And often, even if the fire's coming through, because this is, a bog wetland down here, hopefully they're able to, find a wet area to even just get across and wait until that fire comes through and kind of wind their way on back around. But we really don't have any way of knowing at this point.
Yeah, we'll have to check back with you and find out how this manifests. I've been around fires in wildlife areas, and the animals take to the water. Deer, you'll find deer just standing, in the water,
mm-hmm.
With fires burning all around. So they do have this innate knowledge about what to do.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the complicating aspects of this particular fire is the fact that it's been so very dry that actually the water resources are somewhat limited.
Well, you are right about that. We are experiencing a drought here in the Okefenokee Swamp, which is certainly a complicated matter. We were already seeing concentrations of alligators where you normally wouldn't see that many alligators in one area. Spring is mating season for the alligators, and normally they become more territorial during that time. And so you're seeing, a drought. So you've got a concentration of alligators at a time when they become more territorial and aggressive toward each other. Their food supply is dwindling because their food is the fish and the snakes and turtles and frogs and whatnot that you would find in that environment, the same as the alligator inhabits. Well, it's affecting the fish as well as it's affecting the alligator. So as their food supplies dwindle, they will turn cannibalistic and turn on each other. And we did have an incident of that happen a couple of weeks ago before the fire started. We had a report of someone seeing that happen. So, and that's, not unusual, too. Just naturally for that to happen if you have a big alligator that might prey on a smaller alligator. But it is a sign of, some stress and in the environment. And so you've already got a low water level down here, and then you have this big fire come through where you have less wet areas for animals to go for protection. So that is a factor that plays into it.
In terms of the open water, how deep typically in a normal season would the waters be? And obviously, if they can get into those waters, they're protected.
Well, it really does vary because when I mentioned earlier that open, wet, shallow prairies, by shallow, I mean inches.
Right.
So you have prairies out there where your wading birds normally are feeding at. And, those prairies are drying up, have dried up, are drying up.
Mm-hmm.
There are canals or channels out there where alligators would normally be. At the deepest, most places in the swamp, maybe 10, 12, 14 feet deep.
Right.
Maybe a little bit deeper. So we're just seeing, significant drying of a lot of those areas.
Well, we'll have to see what happens. And you make the point that this is a natural occurrence. This certainly is not the first time that the swamps have been burned. They've been burning for thousands and thousands of years. So the animals that you find there are pretty well adapted, and they may get a hit. There's definitely going to be a hit.
Well, you're right about that. And it is a cycle, and the swamp does need it for rejuvenation. Like I said earlier, that it would basically just turn into, a scrub shrub boggy area if it didn't burn out. And historically you have these big fires, and this is what we're seeing is basically a part of that natural cycle, because the last really big fire like this that the swamp had was back in 1954 or 55, and the same conditions existed then. You have a drought period where a lot of that peat dries out, and then you'll have a wildfire come through and it will burn down into that peat, burn that peat out, open those lakes up, and it's part of that cycle. And so we are at about that 50-year period, and we are in that drought period. So all the things were sort of in line for something like this on a natural level to occur. That doesn't mean it's not devastating at the time that it happens, and certainly we want to work to protect any interest around the swamp, and homes and lives are our priority.
I think the bottom line is the fact that, yes, there's going to be animals that are going to go down in this process, but it is a natural process. It's happened many times before, and I would guess that if we talk 5 years from now, you'll have a whole different story. So as you look out into the future, how is this going to affect your role at the wildlife refuge?
Well, it's something that we already do, is try to explain to people the role of fire in this ecosystem. It also serves to highlight why we do prescribe burning, that's usually a good thing because it burns out those fuels that would accumulate and just add to that fire when something like this does happen. So, prescribed burning is a good thing, something that you can control, and you do it in a very methodical, scientific way. So, we're prepared for when something like this comes, or as prepared as you can be.
Well, I think it's interesting. It's almost as if there's really been kind of a change, that people who are involved in refuge management and wildlife management, obviously these are tragedies in many different ways, and there's certainly issues that, in terms of protecting property and your facilities, et cetera. But in reality, I would guess that you sort of look at this as, this is part of nature expressing itself.
Well, a long time ago, they used to try to put out those fires at the Okefenokee Swamp. You know, they would send in into the swamp itself, you know, try every resource that they had, you know, flying through the swamp, and it just doesn't work. I mean, experience has just shown, you know, the cost is just prohibitive, just incredible. And it's logistically impossible to get the equipment and the firefighters out there in that swamp to fight it. So what we do as an agency is we maintain a perimeter boundary around it, a fire line, if you will. And we keep that. We work with local landowners, local agencies like Georgia Forestry Commission, and we all work together. In fact, there's a partnership called the Greater Okefenokee Association of Landowners, and they meet regularly and discuss, and they work together when they have fires, no matter, you know, well, whoever's land it's on, they work together. They have a plan of action when something like this happens. And so now we have these big fires, and there's a plan in place, and everybody's working together cooperatively very well in handling this.
Wildlife refuges are precisely that, wildlife refuges, but they also, let me rephrase that, wildlife refuges, but they also offer recreational activities. I think at this point the swamp is closed to the public, but once it reopens, tell us what people will be experiencing when they come there and what sort of recreational resources they can expect.
When they come to the Okefenokee Swamp after these fires go through, it's going to look different. People may remember back when Yellowstone burned. And there was a backlash about letting it burn. They wanted it put out because it looked bad and whatever. And the same thing is going to happen here. It's, you know, people don't want to come to the swamp and see burnt areas. But that's going to be part of what it is. But the swamp is going to rejuvenate itself very quickly. I mean, it's going to green back up very quickly. The birds are going to come back. The wildlife's going to come out. And, you know, life is going to resume as normal for the wildlife and the refuge and the swamp out there.
And that's the exciting news in reality.
Mm-hmm.
Strangely enough, oftentimes the restorative feature that adds more diversity and increases the amount of life and time.
Mm-hmm.
Very nice.
That's right.
We've been talking with Ranger Sally Gentry with the Okefenokee Swamp National Wildlife Refuge in Georgia that's been going through the fires. If people want to find out more about the resource, where should they go?
Well, we do have a website, and it's called www.fws, which is short for Fish and Wildlife Service, .gov/Okefenokee.
You better spell that.
Okefenokee.
Well, thank you so much, and good luck in the weeks ahead here, and maybe we'll have a chat again to see how things are recovering.
Thank you, Sydney.
Keep your eyes open, and be particularly careful to avoid doing anything that could set our world on fire. Things are heating up in more ways than one, and we must make special efforts to do the right things. So be careful until next week when we meet again on Thursday or any time on the archives when the weekly Earth Summit reconvenes. This is Sydney Wildsmith saying adios. See you next week when your voice of the Earth continues here on the Wild Side News.